Hi, everybody. Today is Monday, November 11th. Dan is here with us. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be back.
Let's get started with the new president of the United States, Donald Trump. What are the main difficulties that he's going to face in terms of what's going on in the Middle East? Let's put it this way. Is he interested in solving the problems in the Middle East, in your opinion?
No. I mean, the thing is that we have to look at, it's not Trump's victory per se. It's the Democrats' loss. They ran, you know, the worst campaign with the worst candidate that they absolutely could have come up with. And they were, they created this monster they call Trump, and as something that would be easy to defeat. That was the whole point. They stole the populist idea from the other party, kicked out their own populist guy, and then gave over their party to the Cheneys and the other half of the Republican Party to stop him. I mean, and it didn't work. And it's really important to lay that out, because you have to, you know, look at what's happening from two perspectives. One is the rest of the world, which could give a damn about who is running the United States. Obviously, there's a transition period. The election was a complete surprise to a lot of people. Not to me. Remember, Nima, I said last week, I said 100 electoral votes and he only won by 86. So, but I was pretty close. But the other thing is the American people. Does he represent some sort of will on behalf of the people, and more importantly, the faction of capital which elected him to office? In other words, the people that are in power now. And so if he, you're talking about change when you come into any sort of change at all, especially in historical terms, you're talking about the system that has been in place and has been unseating elected governments around the world from A to Z, you know, for decades and decades. And of course, you can zoom in now and say, like, since Libya, at least, maybe, you have this, the neocons basically having a stranglehold on both the State Department and the intelligence and military communities. And so that was a complete obstacle to anything else being pursued. Now, what happened? Those people weren't unelected. They were never elected in the first place. They weren't replaced. The philosophy that they represent hasn't been changed out. Like, there is no, you know, we don't know basically what Trump is going to do. What is the United States? What is the ruling class going to do? You know, that all has to be filtered down on all those levels I just mentioned. In terms of Trump's ability to change it, what is remarkable about Trump is he doesn't give a damn what people think. And so to the extent that his personality has an impact on policy, he can stick to his main things, which is waste of money, waste of time, and inefficient non-solutions to ongoing problems. And those are the things that he likes to write about and talk about. And they do have some relevance to what he did in his first term. He didn't start any new wars. He used behind the scenes. He sent up more drones than Obama did in his entire 8 years, even though drones only came in to such production in the second half. He wasn't shy, and he wasn't an anti-war candidate. He participated in trying to overthrow Venezuela. He's been, you know, talked incessantly about attacking Iran, and then China was always in the front front and center. So it's a mistake to think that he will change any of these basic problems that a dying empire has on maintaining its hegemony and its edge over the global economy with respect to its competitors, which is now redefined as BRICS and all these, the triangle of Russia, China, Iran in the security and military realm. And so it's not something that is you can say he won, therefore X. No. And look at the Middle East. He is the president who actually pushed the transfer of the capital from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which was, it's like the one China policy. It's an enormous red line. And you can't say that anyone is going to take him more seriously. What can he do? What he can do, I suppose, is have a bigger hand in nudging Netanyahu and forcing, look, this is crazy. This isn't going to work for us, right? We're not. This proxy war is too much. And to be honest and open, he has a very strong history of support, like the capital move I just mentioned, and overwhelming support for what Israel is and does, that he might have some personal leverage there. But again, let's take that from the other perspective. Like I said, the rest of the world, he's not in control of anything. The U.S. military is not in control of anything. Look now at what Iran is doing, what the Ansarullah movement is doing in the Red Sea, what Hezbollah is doing and the Hamas is doing in Gaza. I mean, it's not, none of that changed from November 5th to November 6th. And you still have this transition now where the Biden administration is still in control. There's some rumors about transferring air defense systems to occupied parts of Northeast Syria that the U.S. still controls. It still is exactly as dangerous and scary as it was before the election. I think that people misunderstand that, or they think that this is some magical moment that Trump is going to do this, that, and the other, when I don't see, you see some changes, but again, we're reading tea leaves. Now, what Kushner is not welcome to be involved at all anymore. He even put out his own tweet saying that Haley and Pompeo were not invited to be part of this administration. And I think that's important. These are, and also, oh, right, the tweet between Don Jr. and Dave Smith, where he said, we got to keep these people out. No neocons, no, these people have got to keep their distance from the Trump administration, this Trump administration, because they infected it last time and it was a disaster. And Don Jr. says, 100, 100, 100. I agree. I'm working on that right now. Okay. I mean, but it's Twitter. You know, it's X, should say it correctly, because Musk is so important now that he's a third party on phone calls between, you know, heads of state. So, you know, we got to take it seriously. That's like giving Obama, remember the Peace Prize before he even took office? Like, here, please don't ruin. He said, well, I'll take Libya. We tortured some folks. we can't do anything we want. You can't make these, it's all speculation. It looks like he realizes that he was too much under control of that wing of the party, not to mention that Pompeo was a bombastic idiot, and Nikki Haley is just a non-thinker, you know. But also, from the point of view of the UN, of international diplomacy, she represented a horrific wing of the GOP, which isn't any different from the Democrats right now. I mean, Blinken? Austin? I mean, really? You know, where is he going to get thinkers, critical thinkers, and historians who see the writing on the wall? You know, I mean, look at what he did in the Ukrainian situation, where he comes up and in that, I think the Washington Post is just full of crap. That thing was a complete lie. I don't, Peskov says it never happened. That the phone call with Putin, where he told him that we have a significant presence in Western Europe. Like, I mean, even making up things to print is really out of touch with reality, because no president should say that to President Putin, because it means they've taken their eye off the ball. Then you come to the thing that really happened, where he actually talked to Zelensky with Musk on speaker, whatever the hell that means. No way, you know, we can think about that for a decade. Why is he going to drive one of those trash can cars around, be like a EV in Washington DC? But what he said was that we could NATO, they can think about joining NATO in 20 years, and they can keep their, you know, it's huge to say that Crimea is done. And it's huge to say that we're not going to reoccupy any areas that Russia completely occupied. No, that's not huge. That's actually not being completely psychotically delusional, like all of the speakers on the Western side have been this whole time. They're saying things without looking at a map, without even, I don't know if they have YouTube. I mean, how do they say what they've said about it being a stalemate? Remember all these things about how, they, you know, the Kursk thing to begin with, and coming back to square one still has to be understood in an American context. And what he said to Putin, I mean, to Zelensky, sorry, about Putin and about that situation, was ludicrous. The Russians are not going to say it's okay for Ukraine to join NATO in 20 years. Here's a word, never. Oh, neutral, two N-words. Maybe you don't understand. You can get Roger's thesaurus and kind of look that up and see if you can figure out the words that are coming out of my mouth. No. And the rest of Zaporozhye, Donetsk, Lugansk, now these are part of Russia. So is he saying we're going to start talking by asking Russia to change their constitution, and then we'll go back and sit down to the same points that we wasted time on and used as a lure at Minsk? No. That is never going to be a starting point with the Ukrainian situation. Now, I bring it up because the overlap, I think, is clear. What are you going to say in the Mideast if you have yet to encompass the distance that the administration that you've been criticizing, dumping on day after day after day, if you don't understand the enormous gulf between their political posturing and reality? And just coming back a little bit, even with the Pompeo and Nikki Haley thing, I think a lot of analysts are intrigued by that, or that raises eyebrows. But I'm looking a little deeper and seeing there's no change in very basic outlook and the way that they are going to. What is, see, this is my thing. What is the rump state of Israel going to look like? Right? Can you imagine stating a question like that in one of these idiot conference rooms with all of them bowing to Donald Trump and telling, like, that's not even within the realm of human possibility. So they are so far away from what could be solutions that I don't understand how they are going to bring about any changes to policy. Nina, it's very clear they can do what Spain did. Was it Spain? Who just said, we're not going to, no ships are going to dock here if they have American cargo, because they've been lying and they've been switching arms. They just have to say the same thing. You can't have all these. So the provider of 70% of the weapons during this genocide can't, you know, are you going to provide 68, 62 and a half, maybe, you know, bring it down a tiny bit? It's like drinking your coffee with less cream or something. If you can't, that it's so basic that even his bluster and fake honesty, I think, hits a wall there. I don't know. I don't know what he's going to do. That's what I hate to say it so bluntly.
How about what's going on right now in the Middle East in terms of the new summit in Saudi Arabia between all the Arab countries, Muslim countries? Do you feel that they're getting to the point that they totally understand what's going on with Israel and the way that Israel is attacking all of the neighboring countries? Syria, you see in the West Bank, in Gaza, Lebanon,
yeah,
in reaction with Iran. And how, in your opinion, how is it going to be in the mind of these Arab countries in terms of the solution? I'm talking about the solution that they're, it seems that they're getting to the point that they understand what's going on, but how much of these type of activity, this summit and the talks that Erdogan, the head of these states, are talking about, would be translated, would be interpreted in their actions?
Yeah, that's exactly the way you framed that question is perfect. It's they obviously can see what's going on. There's always a difference between the street and the elites. You know, what people feel. Iran has been forefront in not backing down, not making its individual and unitary peace with Israel while the other attacks in southern Lebanon and Gaza are going on. And that makes sense. That's kind of pushes toward a new unity, which has been elusive. Now, the monarchies, like Jordan, has always been very pro-Western. The change in Saudi Arabia's stance, now that they have kind of calmed things down with Iran, they are not just the sole kind of outpost of the nice guys, you know, for Western policy in the Middle East. And that is a different, those are different things that are shaping up differently. Erdogan is still, it's like he's, you know, kind of waiting on the outside door to BRICS, and he wants to keep both options open. And that's what I mean to say is that they're not, the issue is not what is happening in Israel. The issue is what is happening with U.S. empire and what changes have been made and what changes will be made to allow any reasonable actions, anything that is like Iran started to do. If you do this to us, we'll do this to you. If you if you invade these people, we won't allow you to settle here. All those things have to be settled from what they used to call an even playing field, which I hate because it makes the whole thing sound like college athletics or something, that it's a soccer game or something. But you have the China's intervention in mitigating talks between Iran and Saudi Arabia. You have the idea of people joining either SCO or BRICS now, of protecting other oil producers like Venezuela, and the anger over stealing Syria's oil, which came up in Trump's first administration. So that's obviously hasn't changed, because now that same guy is back in office. But also, it is further reaching in terms of how they develop distance, stability, and sustainability in a global market that does not bow to the dollar and to U.S. hegemony and the military and political hegemony that follows from the economic. And I think that as that becomes clear, and I really think it's becoming clearer than it has ever been, at least in my lifetime, as that becomes clearer, the Arab states will feel more empowered to express their own sovereignty. And that goes in terms of interacting with each other without, you know, it can, that will help tamp down Shia Sunni confrontation. It will help within the individual countries like Hezbollah and the Christian groups in Lebanon, and it will help with global trade. You know, if they do this, if they sit, I really don't think that they're going to sit down in Riyadh and say, we're all going to invade at once. I don't see how that, I don't see any big thing like that happening. I know other analysts have been talking about it, that the, you know, Israeli defense is crumbling and this is all, you know, but it really comes down to the balance with the power the United States has. And you have to kind of zoom out again and see how that has changed. Even in the last 4 years, China is not China, Russia is not Russia. Venezuela is under, and Cuba are under different protection than they were just a few years ago, because by breaking that barrier, by putting his foot down, basically, Russia's Putin said, we're not going to listen to you tell us what to do. And it also comes back to this hemisphere as well. The U.S. has always thought, since the Monroe Doctrine, that the Latin America is their backyard. And that had been a reason to absolutely do whatever we wanted in the Central American states and in South America. Now you look at, President Xi is going to be at the G20 and the APEC summit this week, and he's going to inaugurate the opening of the new let's see, my mind is going Chungking. The Belt and Road Initiative is the port that they've built just north of Lima that will make take 10 days off of intercoastal transport of goods from 35 to 25 days if from China to South America. Like, and these are huge things. It may seem like kind of boring. He's going to oversee the opening of this, but that's what has been happening. Actually, I think that was starting to happen in Libya, which is partly, you know, the Chinese lost billions of dollars worth of investment and infrastructure in that boondoggle. And that is what is on Trump's agenda, is keeping China from rising. And that has as much to do with the Middle East as it does with Peru and Ukraine and the rest of North Africa. These are all, they're hotspots for a reason, because they are the points at which the old order is being challenged. And I think you can kind of look at it like, did the Muslim majority in Dearborn, in Michigan, that went for Jill Stein and not for either of the other two candidates, did that make Michigan fall and therefore the dominoes that led to this win for Donald Trump, especially in the Electoral College? I know it sounds like far-fetched, but what I'm saying is that tiny individual confrontations are part of a larger picture that you have to keep looking at. You have to keep saying, how, well, you know, we don't know. If all of a sudden it's not normal for a country to say that they can occupy another country and take over, and exterminate their indigenous population, this changes a lot about how international politics works. And I think we're on the cusp of that. And I think that in itself is a huge accomplishment. I don't know that in the next week you're going to see it written down in bullet point form by the Arab states. I just don't see how they can dictate what happens, except, you know, they can agree on if then, you know, oil embargo terms, Iran closing off or imposing a sort of selective barricade in the Straits of Hormuz. Many different things that have to do with the U.S. support for Israel, and say, wait a minute, no, you're going to pay a price. And they can do each of those things. So we may see more of that happening, and I think that would be very helpful. But I don't think there's one like linchpin that they can pull.
How about the conflict in Ukraine right now? When you see the European Union, they're talking about that we have to defeat Russia. The same type of rhetoric that we've seen so far for more than, it's going to be 3 years. We are approaching 3 years of the conflict in Ukraine. And on the other hand, the government right now in the United States, the Biden administration, is interested in the continuation of the conflict, as Jake Sullivan was talking about this. They're trying to do everything at their disposal. Yeah. How do you see the difficulties that Donald Trump and his administration would face in terms of Ukraine?
Well, so, yeah, I probably should have, waited for this portion to talk about all the Ukraine stuff, because I was using it as a foil for the Middle East. But yes, now in this case, you have those same confrontations and conflicts between the incoming administration and the outgoing administration, and the history of the conflict itself. Now you have Rutte, Mark Rutte, the head of NATO, or is he president of the EU? I can't tell them apart anymore anyway. But he said if Trump doesn't strips NATO of support for Ukraine, then he's going to personally see that the U.S. is ejected from NATO. And I said, what? What are these guys smoking? Then Macron and Starmer were, meeting to try to talk through some way of pushing Biden to let them shoot storm shadows on Moscow or something. And you're thinking, what? I mean, that's what I was talking about a few minutes ago when I said Trump thinks it makes sense, or that it's more reasonable to present the plans that he's thinking of, when what you see is those people are crazy. You think that it's somehow going to advance what agenda exactly? To shoot storm shadows and ballistic missiles deep into Russian territory. That's the stupidest thing I can imagine. And it's the Russians have been increasingly clear constantly about how that will only lead to further destruction. Zelensky, in that weird phone call, appeared to have nothing to come back with about that plan to cede the territories that have been occupied, right? And then, but if you look at a map and you see that the Russian army hasn't even retaken the full oblasts of Zaporozhye and the other three to their administrative districts, which have already been annexed to the Russian Federation. So they don't, that's the starting point would be to do something to their disinterest at the end of a war. I don't understand that. The other thing is an 800-mile DMZ, right? So this is Korea 2.0. I cannot imagine the Russians going for this. I cannot imagine. Oh, and the idea was that you wouldn't, to escape the potential conflict with NATO troops or US troops, you'd have UK troops and EU troops, not NATO and not US. What the hell does that even mean? Who are those? And what would the difference? That is insane to think that it is something to suggest in a DMZ with Western troops on your border. What are you thinking? And to whom is this actually being suggested? It wasn't suggested to Putin, or at least not according to Dmitry Peskov, who came out today or yesterday and said that the Washington Post is full of crap. And that's completely believable, because they have been the whole time. They've been printing lie after lie after lie. So they said no conversation like that took place. And so the only one we're left with is the one that was widely reported on with Zelensky, in which he said that about the demilitarized zone, the 20-year fend off of NATO, and nothing else, no other changes, nothing like Russia being a second language, right, and stopping the persecution of Russian culture in the rest of Ukraine. And that's non-negotiable too. But you're talking to a regime that spent billions of dollars brainwashing the whole society by changing the songs that their kids learn at school to say, kill the Moskalis. Like, this is not, you can't take incremental steps from that. The what is true on the ground is still true on the ground. And just, and the whole point, one of the mappers that I watched was saying that, you know, Musk was included because he owns all these satellites. So he basically knows everything that's going on. He has maps and where all the Russian missiles are and where they're all this, whatever. And I'm thinking, well, if they can see all that, why can't they see reality? Like, this is not, they have to admit that they were wrong. And I don't mean like they have to bow down and say mea culpa and, you know, to what do they call it in the law when you give your legal apology. No, I'm talking about in terms of how they see the development of the facts on the ground, in terms of where their troops are and where they're going to be. They can't believe the false stories that have been printed over and over. They have to look at, the Russians are advancing quite rapidly. They're kicking those Ukrainians out of Kursk. They're just plodding along to do what they have been going to do all along. And since that hasn't changed, you cannot then go back and try to reset that button and have a new, let's talk a new, because first of all, remember, you're talking to Americans. We got treaties and America, they don't really go together. We don't really care if we signed a treaty. You know, we're just going to do what we did with the native populations. We'll sign it, yeah, and say, and it will be absolutely worthless within 24 hours. And the Russians and the Chinese are increasingly aware that this is how that shop runs. So they are looking for, when they say security agreements, they mean facts on the ground. They want Ukraine to have no more than 30,000 troops. Hey, you know what? We're not having a big Western, and no foreign troops, and no NATO, not now, not ever. And if they can't come up with that, well, I don't know. The other side of that, of course, is that a war is extremely expensive. It's extremely emotionally draining. It's a disaster in terms of the cost of human life. And that can't, whether people support the objectives, a war is never going to be popular at home. It can't be, because people are afraid of their, you know, sons and brothers and fathers and cousins getting killed. And so there is an enormous will to make it stop. So if they decide, and again, like I always say, it's nice to be able to talk and have no one interrupt you, but it's not my country, it's not my people, and it's not my history. You know, I have to defer to their need to make it stop. If they collectively, or through the general staff, through the office of President Putin, through the armed forces of the Russian Federation, if they decide that some compromise like that is worth it, and they have a strategy in which to kind of work out a true resolution, then I wouldn't blame them for it. And I think that is possible, but I think it's the least likely possibility. Remember also that they are now working in conjunction with China, in close relations that they've never had before, with that being one of Trump's mandates, is that he wants to make kind of push them apart, push India and Russia apart, push Iran and Russia apart, and China and Russia apart. And as ludicrous as that is, it has overflow into all of these other situations. If you don't want to look like you're compromising with the enemy on one side of the equation, and then have to defend your new allies on the other side of the equation. It just doesn't work that way. And that's what I come back to what I was saying about the whole pot is boiling and it's changing everywhere. And so that has an effect on how it will change one issue at a time. You know, no, we can't agree to a DMZ because what would that say to all of our BRICS incorporees? You know, what does it say to our trade status? What does it say to our security agreements with North Korea and with Iran? So I think that they waited too long, Nima. They just waited too long to adapt to any new realities or face any changes. And they're still on the losing side, and they are going to suffer the losses that come with that.
Yeah. I think that would be interesting to see how the Trump administration going to manage the situation and their policy. Nobody knows. Everybody's interested in that.
Right, because what his thing is win peace through strength. Well, okay, but that doesn't mean anything about losing. And that's one thing that he and the Americans are really bad at, is losing. I mean, the sore loser thing is extremely dangerous, which is why we're all on the edge of our seats in the, you know, thermonuclear fear. You know,
Thank you so much, Dan, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Okay. Good night.
Good night. Boa noite.